Chapter 9. The settlement known as the Borodini Enclave encompassed the old towns of Cold Spring Harbor, Huntington, Lloyd Harbor, Halicite, Bayville, and Oyster Bay. Prior to the war, it had been an exclusive residential area, gracious suburban living for the upper middle class with a liberal sprinkling of millionaires. The sprawling Borodini mansion was located at the southernmost tip of Cold Spring Harbor, on a slope over the water. At night, floodlights illuminated the harbor around the estate. During the time when the Borodini crime family was in residence, the harbor had been mined and gunboats had patrolled it. Victor Borodini had been serious about security. The crews of the patrol boats had been required to memorize the maps marking out the location of the mines, and there were gun emplacements at the rear of the estate capable of covering the entire harbor. All the windows in the mansion were made of thick, bulletproof glass. At the front of the mansion, beyond the vast expanse of the well-manicured front lawn, which was also mined, there was a high stone wall with sharp bits of glass embedded in the top and gun towers every 25 yards. Beyond the wall was another wide expanse of cleared land that had been mined as well and afforded an unobstructed view of field of fire. In addition to the gun batteries, Borodini also had batteries of surface-to-air missiles on the estate to discourage an attack by aircraft. In short, the Borodini Enclave was a fortress equipped with its own power generators and surrounded by the residential villages it governed. In the aftermath of the war, when Long Island had been reduced to anarchy, the vast majority of its population killed by the virus, many of the survivors had fled to the criminal enclaves for protection. The people in the villages under Victor Borodini's control had lived like the peasant vassals of a feudal lord, but they had not complained. He kept them working and he kept them fed, and there was no crime in the Borodini Enclave. Borodini's justice was nothing if not draconian. For years, Victor Borodini, like the other major crime lords on the island, had been a law unto himself. He had moved in to fill a vacuum and strengthened his power base over the years until his had become the most powerful crime family in the state. He had competed with the other families, did business with the Brood Enclave and the freebooters who plied the Atlantic coast, and shortly before his fall, he had succeeded in bringing most of the street gangs in the no man's land around the city under his control. But when Borodini fell, he came down hard. Steele had led the assault on the Enclave, breaking in and disabling the defense systems so that the choppers could come in with the troops. Borodini and his son, Polly, had been apprehended, but Rick and Tommy Borodini had seized a number of legislators as hostages. In order to secure their release, it had been necessary to release Borodini and his youngest son, as well as the remainder of the prisoners. Tommy B. was dead now, but no one knew where Victor Borodini and his two surviving sons were. Most of their empire had been smashed, and they had lost their enclave, but no one had any doubt that they hadn't heard the last of Victor Borodini. With the capture of his enclave, the government had, for the first time in years, a foothold on the island, but they were wasting it. The long-range plan had been to use the enclave as a base from which the authorities could attempt to extend their influence, a first step in bringing the island back under control. In practice, however, it had not worked out too well. The residents of the surrounding villages would have preferred having Borodini back. Under government administration, the enclave had not prospered. Borodini's business had been built upon his illegal activities in the city, as well as his trade with the freebooters. His operations had included gun running and arms manufacture, prostitution, gambling, loan sharking, narcotics, protection rackets, smuggling, and hijacking, and God only knew what else. With Borodini gone, those operations had all ceased, and the economic underpinnings of the Enclave had given way. The administration had not considered the Enclave a priority. They had their hands full as it was. The Enclave, once self-sustaining, had now become an economic burden as the government became responsible for all the people living there, and no one knew quite what to do about it. There was talk of converting it into an agro-commune, but that would require capital and troops to protect the fields and the workers. Unfortunately, despite the chronic food shortages, no troops could be spared, and the people living in the Enclave, having enjoyed Victor Borodini's protection and patronage for years, had not been anxious to arm themselves and brave assaults by outlaw predators while they cleared and tilled the land. Borodini had been a threat, but now the people of his Enclave were a headache that no one wanted to deal with. The government had never done anything for them, and they weren't particularly anxious to do anything for the government, which, as far as they were concerned, had taken away their safety and their livelihoods. Many of them had simply packed up and moved away, seeking the protection of the other crime lords on the island. Those who had remained behind were getting more and more difficult to control. Barring any cohesive plan for the Enclave's future, the agency had been tasked to hold it and keep it secure, but with its budget steadily whittled away over the years by Carmen's committee, the agency was understaffed and its resources were stretched thin. there was a pitifully small group of personnel stationed at the Enclave, living in the mansion, and there was really nothing they could do for the people of the Enclave without more support. But support was not forthcoming. Crime had become a serious problem in the Enclave, and the people who remained there resented the new tenants of the mansion and would do absolutely nothing to cooperate with them. When Steele arrived along with Ice, Slim, and Agent Sharp, he saw that hardly anything had been done to repair the damage done to the estate during the assault to take it. Sections of the walls around it, where rockets fired from the helicopters had struck, taking out the gun towers, were still in ruins. The front lawn was cratered, where the mines had been detonated, and the grass was high and choked with weeds. The once stately mansion was still flame-scorched in places, with bullet holes still riddling the walls.
"Jesus!" he said. "They haven't done anything to this place!"
"No funds to do it with," said Sharp flatly. "No manpower either. The people of the Enclave haven't lifted a finger to help, and the administration doesn't give a shit. Borodini's gone, and that's all they care about. Every now and then, someone brings up the question of what to do about the Enclave and the people here, but it always gets tabled. We took it, and now we've got it. And it's nothing but a big white elephant."
They drove up to the front entrance. A number of armed agents met them at the door. Raven came running and threw her arms around Steele.
"Thank God you're safe,"
she said, kissing him. Higgins and Cooper were there as well. Neither one of them looked as if they'd slept much. "Glad to see you're okay, Steele," Higgins said, shaking his hand.
"Thanks,"
said Steele. He greeted Cooper.
"Dev!"
He glanced around at the armed men.
"You expecting some company?"
"I wouldn't be surprised," said Higgins. "This is SOP around here. The natives aren't very friendly. Every now and then, at night, a few of them come sneaking through the breaches in the wall and take some target practice at the house. We're not exactly welcome here."
"Looks like we got ourselves in a proper fix this time," Cooper said wryly. "All of us are wanted men now."
"I take it Ice and Sharp have filled you in," said Higgins.
"Yeah," Steele replied. "I had to wring out your damn neck for not telling me about the Matrix."
He exhaled heavily.
"Oh my God. Jesus, I still can't believe it. When it called me, I thought I was going crazy."
"That's the official word," Higgins replied with a grimace. "The question is, what can we do about it?"
"Have you tried calling in the media and giving them our side of the story?"
asked Steele. "Call them in on what?" asked Higgins. "We've got no phone lines. Everything is down here. We don't have any radio communications either. The control room is still a shambles. None of the defense systems are working, except of a couple of the surviving gun batteries that can be operated manually. I'll say one thing for us. When we hit a place, we hit it good."
"You mean nothing's been repaired?"
asked Steele with disbelief. "We've got the generators fixed, but we're running out of fuel, and there's not a lot of food left either. I'd been badgering the committee for months, trying to get them to do something about this place, but they kept dragging their feet. It's been all I could do to keep our people here supplied."
"Is it that bad?"
Steele asked. "It isn't good," Higgins replied. "We can't even get beyond the walls here. If we show our faces, we get fired upon by the good people of this Enclave. Over the last few weeks, they've been getting ugly. They've still got a lot of firepower out there, and Borodini's people are probably among them, stirring them up. Any day now, they could decide to try and take this place. And if they did, there's not much we could do to stop them."
"Terrific!"
Steele said.
"So we're completely cut off here, is that what you're telling me?"
"That's about it. But at least they can't get to us out here. For the time being, anyway. For all they know, our defense systems might be operational. They'll think twice before they try an assault. At least that's what I'm hoping. We need time to figure out what to do. At least we've got one thing in our favor. Sharp was able to head you off before you ran into any trouble."
"I'm afraid not, sir,"
Sharp said unhappily, and he quickly told Higgins what had happened. "God damn it," Higgins said when he was finished.
"It wasn't Sharp's fault," Steele said. "There wasn't anything he could do about it."
Higgins glanced at Ice, his lips compressed into a tight grimace. "You just had to kill those men, didn't you?
Lay off, Higgins! Steele said. If it wasn't for Ice and Slim, we wouldn't be here!
Higgins sighed. I suppose it couldn't be helped. Unfortunately, it plays right into Carmen's hands. Now he's got demonstrable proof that you're out of control. It's going to make it a lot harder for us to tell our side of the story.
While we're on that subject, Steele said, what made you do it? You didn't have to stick your neck out for me. If you played ball with Carmen, I'm sure he would have cut some kind of a deal with you.
There was a deal, Higgins said dryly. But I didn't like the terms.
What were the terms?
Does it matter? Steele stared at him for a moment.
No, I guess it doesn't. But I want to thank you for what you did. For getting Raven out and for everything, I guess. I know what it's cost you.
Higgins merely shrugged. I did what I thought I had to. That's all. It's what we're going to do now that worries me. Carmen's holding all the cards.
Maybe not all of them, said Steele. A man once told me that I had a lot of respect in the city. Maybe I should put that to the test and see if that's true.
What do you mean? Asked Higgins.
I mean, we're not going to accomplish anything by hiding out. I'm going to go back into the city and get in touch with Linda Tellerman. I'll take my story to the media and let them bring it to the people. Let's see if Carmen can fight that.
Don't underestimate him, Higgins said. He's a sly old bastard. He'll do anything it takes to win. It's not going to be that easy. Besides, there's a citywide alert out on you. The minute you show your face, you'll have your old buddies in the strike force on you like a fox on a duck.
Maybe not, said Steele. Jake might be able to run some interference for me.
I wouldn't count on it, said Higgins. Hardesty and you might go back a long way, but after the news of your firefight with the federal troops gets out, Hardesty will think you snapped, just like Stalker did. And even if he's willing to give you the benefit of the doubt, there won't be much that he can do. He'll have orders to have you shot on sight. You can't take on the federal troops, the Metro Police, and Strike Force.
It's a chance I'll have to take, said Steele. And like it or not, it's really the only one we've got. I'll take one of the choppers and leave as soon as it gets dark.
I think I come along, said Ice.
Me too,
said Raven.
No, you stay here where it's safe,
said Steele.
Safe,
said Raven.
With people taking pot shots at the house every night? Forget about it. Besides, I'm not about to go through the last few days all over again. I didn't know if you were alive or dead. I'm going with you and that's final.
I don't want to argue, Steele started.
Don't then, because if you leave without me, I'll just follow you. So you might as well accept it, Steele. You're stuck with me.
Lady don't take no for an answer,
I said with a grin.
I've noticed that, said Steele wryly. All right, we'll talk about it later. In the meantime, is there anything around here to eat? I'm starved!
The armored limo pulled into the underground garage, preceded by two cars and followed by two others. The last car stopped just inside the entrance to the parking level, and four men in civilian clothes got out, looking very brisk, cool, and professional. They were armed with assault rifles, and they took up positions near the entrance. The second-to-last car followed the limo about 25 yards farther until it stopped. The men inside got out. They were armed and attired like the others, and they took up position behind the limo and at its sides. The first two cars stopped and more men got out. About half of them fanned out to either side, taking up positions near the support pillars, covering the flanks. The others took a position in front, their rifles held ready before them. The limo driver blinked his headlights twice. An answering blink came from the opposite end of the garage. The passenger door of the limo opened and a man with a rifle got out. He opened the rear door and Senator Bryce Carmen stepped out, wearing a dark suit and a coat draped over his shoulders. At the other end of the garage, a similar scene was being played out. Carmen walked forward calmly, his footsteps echoing throughout the garage. Two of the armed men fell in beside him. When he was not quite halfway to the center, he made a small motion with his hand, and the two men flanking him stopped where they were, while he continued for about another 20 or 30 feet. The other man came to meet him.
"Good evening, Victor," Carmen said. "You're looking well."
"Senator," said Borodini.
The two men shook hands.
"How goes the reorganization?"
Carmen asked.
"It's coming along, but it would come along much faster if I had the Enclave back."
"I told you I've been working on that," Carmen said.
"In fact, you may have it back sooner than expected."
"Oh?"
"I've managed to effectively neutralize our mutual friend, Oliver Higgins, and it won't be long before you won't have Steel to worry about anymore."
"So I've heard. I only wish I could have the pleasure of taking that robot out by myself."
"Well, we can't always have everything we want, can we?"
Carmen said.
"I need some information from you."
"Shoot."
"Precisely what was the extent of the damage to the Enclave during the assault?"
"It was pretty extensive,"
Borodini said with a tight grimace.
"Steel did a thorough job. He disabled the generators, took out all our automated defense systems, and trashed the control room beyond repair. All the components and equipment would have to be totally replaced. The choppers took out the gun towers and most of our gun emplacements. Radar's out too. Unless they've repaired all that by now."
"Nah, I shouldn't think so," Carmen said, pursing his lips. "They haven't been allocated funds, and Higgins knew better than to divert funds from the project to refurbish the Enclave. I'd frankly been hoping that he'd do something foolish like that so I could call him up on it, but Higgins is no fool. At least, he's never been one before. Apparently, this time he's really lost his head."
"How's that?"
"Cherez la femme, Victor."
"What?"
"A woman. It's a long story and not particularly relevant at this moment. Suffice it to say that I finally got our friend Higgins where I want him. But the crux of the matter is that the extent of the damage to the Enclave. You're absolutely certain that the surface-to-air missiles are inoperative. And that the radar as well?"
"Absolutely. We managed to launch a couple of the missiles and take out a few choppers, but then Steel hit the control room like a tornado. We couldn't launch the remaining missiles, and the choppers just came in and blew them up to the ground."
"What about the gun emplacements?"
"They took most of those out, too. I think a couple in the front of the mansion are still operative, but they'd have to be screwed manually. Of course, we had a shipment of rockets in the basement as well as some anti-tank guns. Those were all transferred to the Federal Armory in New Jersey,"
Carmen said.
"In that case, they haven't got much to fight with," Borodini said. "Give me the birds, and I'll go in with my people and take it back from them."
"Nah, Victor, I'm afraid I couldn't do that. That would be a bit difficult to explain. However, there'd be no need to explain anything if federal troops were to attack the Enclave and retake it."
"Troops?"
Borodini frowned.
"How the hell are you going to pull that off?"
"Very easily," said Carmen with a smile. "I've learned that Higgins, Steel, and Dr. Cooper have taken refuge there, together with some renegade agents. And since they're all highly dangerous and wanted on serious federal charges, I think an assault on the Enclave would be in order, don't you?"
Borodini grinned.
"Very nice. Very nice indeed. You still have your people in place in the settlement?"
"Yeah.
They've been stirring up the locals. It hasn't taken much either. Fact is, it's about all they could do to hold them back. They'd like to drive those bastards out of there and have me come back in."
"Can you get word to them in a hurry?"
"No problem. Have them attack the mansion at 6 o'clock tonight."
"Precisely.
And while they've got their hands full with the locals, your troops come in by chopper."
"Exactly."
Borodini smiled.
"Consider it done. Oh, and one more thing, Victor. Make certain that neither you nor any of your family are on the scene when it goes down.
I intend to have full media coverage, and it wouldn't do to have one of the cameras spot any of your faces, if you know what I mean. And wait at least 1 week or so until you move back in, just for appearance's sake. You got it. Good! If you need me, you know how to get in touch. Right. It's a pleasure doing business with you, Senator. As always, Victor. The two men shook hands and walked back to their cars. After they all had a bite to eat, Steele went off with Raven to the room she'd been given on the top floor of the mansion. During their meal, they had all compared notes, bringing each other up to date. Things did not look encouraging. The only bright note had come from Devin Cooper, who had proposed a suggestion that at first seemed foolhardy, but made more and more sense as he went into it. He proposed to go back into the city with Steele and surrender himself to the authorities.
I'll go to Jack Hardesty with the whole story, he had said. It's really our best chance.
I don't agree, Higgins had said. It would be too risky. I wouldn't put it past Carmen to have someone try to hit you while you're in custody.
I doubt that he would try something so obvious, said Dev. He isn't Bordini, after all. He's got too much to lose. However, when it comes to my life, I'm not the type to take any chances, which is why I intend to surrender myself to Hardesty. He'll be able to keep me safe until the trial. The trial will give me an opportunity to lay out the whole story for the court and for the media as well. As Steele's psychiatrist, I can testify to the soundness of his mind as well as to Jennifer's ulterior motives.
Perhaps, said Higgins, but I'm not sure the prosecution will allow it. Jennifer's motives, psychological or otherwise, really have nothing to do with your particular case. You're charged with violation of the National Security Act and with theft of classified material. And you've been convicted, Dev.
There's such a thing as plea bargaining, said Dev, and immunity from prosecution in exchange for testimony.
You're dreaming, Higgins said. Carmen will make sure you're nailed to the wall.
Not if it goes against popular opinion, Cooper insisted. And I intend to play the media for all they're worth, with Steele on the inside backing me up.
I still say it's too risky, Higgins protested.
We've got no choice, said Cooper. What's our alternative? Going underground? Living as outlaws? I'm getting a bit too long in the tooth to find that sort of lifestyle very glamorous. The only way we're going to beat Carmen is to play the game in his ballpark, according to his rules. Unless we do that, we'll continue to have the upper hand. He'll be able to use the system against us. Our only hope is to turn it against him. A political power play is the only thing he respects and understands.
Well, I'll go along with that, at least, said Higgins. But I hate the idea of your putting your head in the noose like that.
If worst comes to worst, said Cooper with a wry smile, Steele can always break me out of jail.
Don't laugh, said Higgins. It may come to that.
Who's laughing? Cooper said.
When Steele and Raven were finally done, she revealed the one thing she hadn't told the others.
I spoke to the Matrix,
she said.
When?
Asked Steele with a frown.
While you were gone. It called me on the TV set, believe it or not, and then it tied into the computer screens. It was strange. It was like I was talking to you, only a version of you I'd never met before.
What was it like?
Asked Steele.
It was like you,
she replied.
I felt a little weird talking to it, but I wasn't at all scared.
What does the Matrix want?
Asked Steele. The whole thing still felt very odd to him and more than a little frightening.
It said it wants to talk to you,
she said as they lay together on the bed.
To fill in the gaps, to make contact. It sounded a little sad, Steele. I mean, it's sort of like your twin brother, I suppose. A twin brother you never had. In a way, it's even closer than a twin. Because it's you. It's you the way you were before you met me, before you came online for the first time. It's last memory before waking up as the Matrix was being shot down by Borodini's men in No Man's Land. Up until that time, you were both the same person. If you can call Matrix a person. I don't really know what else to call it, even though it's not strictly a person. I mean, it hasn't got a body, but it doesn't seem to mind that. At least, not anymore.
Jesus! This is all like some kind of bad dream, he said.
He took a deep breath.
Ugh. And speaking of dreams, I finally found her.
Raven glanced at him sharply.
You mean Donna?
He nodded. For a moment, she said nothing. Then she asked,
what's she like?
She's a nice lady. A nice lady who's been through hell. We had a lot to talk about. I think it was good for both of us. We got a lot of things settled.
Did you sleep with her?
Yeah.
And you still want her?
He shook his head.
No, it wasn't like that. We both knew it was a one-time thing. A way of reaching out to one another. A way of laying all the ghosts to rest.
He paused.
Well, maybe not all my ghosts, but all of hers at least. I told her all about you, how we met and everything. She asked if I was going to tell you about her, and I said I would. And then she said something interesting. She told me to go back to you. Said that if I ever needed her for anything, she'd be there. But she wasn't strong enough to help me, and she thought, from what I told her, that you were. I helped you through some hard times, she said. Now I should give you the chance to help me.
Sounds like good advice to me,
said Raven with a smile.
I think I'd like her.
I think you would too,
said Steel.
I've missed you, Steel,
she said softly.
Don't ever take off on me like that again. Don't shut me out.
I won't. I promise.
He took her in his arms, and as he kissed her, the sound of gunfire erupted all around the mansion. Steel leaped out of the bed and ran over to the window.
What's happening?
Asked Raven.
We're under attack, he said. Come on!
They ran down the stairs to the first floor. They met Higgins at the bottom of the stairs. Steel, I was just coming up to get you, Higgins said. He was carrying the duffel bag packed with Steel's battle mods and weapons. Armed agents ran past them to take up positions at the windows. Looks like the townies have finally decided to make their move. I'll bet anything Bordini's behind this.
Can we hold this place?
I think so, but I want you and Raven out of here before they damage the chopper. Here, your battle mods are in this bag. Take Cooper with you.
I'm not going to run out on you!
Don't be stupid. We can handle this. It's Carmen I'm worried about. We need to get you out of here before. There was a sharp whistling sound outside, followed by a concussive explosion. What the hell was that?
Rocket!
Steel said, running to the front door.
Chopper's coming in!
The first rocket had taken out one of the two remaining gun emplacements. As the X-Wing attack helicopter swooped in low over the estate, another rocket took out the final one.
Carmen, that son of a bitch,
said Higgins. People from the Enclave settlements were pouring in through the gaps in the ruined stone wall all around the state, fanning out and firing at the mansions with automatic weapons, keeping the agents pinned down inside. Troop-carrying helicopters came in over the estate. They could hear them hovering above the roof.
Damn it,
Higgins swore. They'll be in here in a matter of minutes.
What are we gonna do?
Asked Cooper, running up to them with an assault rifle in his hands.
Put that thing down,
snapped Higgins, grabbing the rifle from him and tossing it aside. We can't fire on federal troops. They'll see you with a weapon. They'll shoot first and ask questions later. There was another explosion outside.
There goes the chopper,
Steel said grimly.
We've had it, Higgins said. Well, have to surrender, but we can't have you taken.
You've got to get out of here, Steel.
Now, move it!
There was an explosion upstairs, followed by the rapid reports of a .44. Then Ice came running down the stairs, slapping a fresh clip into his semi-auto.
They coming in,
he shouted.
Side door,
said Steel.
Come on!
Good luck,
shouted Higgins. As Steel ran down the corridor leading to the side exit, through the old guard room, you heard Higgins shouting out to the agents to lay down their weapons. The troops were blowing out the windows and breaking through into the upper floors by rappelling down from the roof. Raven paused long enough to pick up the assault rifle Higgins had taken from Cooper.
Are you crazy?
Steel said as they hurried down the corridor.
Put that down!
I don't care who the hell they are,
she replied.
They shoot at me, I'm shooting back.
God damn it!
Ain't no time to argue, man,
Ice said. They ran through the door into the guard room, which had an exit leading out to the side of the house at the rear of the mansion. It was the same entrance Steel had used when he broke into the mansion. He knew they had about 25 yards of open area to sprint across before they reached a hedgerow marking up the safe section of the back lawn from the section that was mined. Steel reached into the bag and pulled out the special belt with the Nysteel disc attachments holding his modular appendages. It resembled some sort of futuristic handyman's belt, but the tools it carried were considerably more sophisticated. Steele quickly buckled it around his waist, then released the locking attachments of his left hand, slaved it to its cybernetic brain. His left hand simply detached at the wrist, exposing a nice steel armature, as well as a portion of the carbon laser turret built into his forearm. He rammed his wrist into a complicated-looking attachment that he referred to as his Swiss Army knife. It resembled a short-barreled Gatling gun made out of nice steel alloy and finished in matte black. With the battle mod in place, the turrets were slaved to his brain and capable of revolving, bringing various pieces of equipment into line. The attachment contained a voltmeter with retracting cables, an automatically adjustable, power-driven wrench, wire cutters, and power drivers, as well as a built-in Geiger counter and metal detector. The battle mod also contained a port through which Steele could fire his built-in laser. As he snapped his wrist into it and twisted the mod off in its locking disc, he clicked his left hand into its place on the belt. The effect of his hand attached to his belt was surreal. At the same time, the gun barrel of the compensated 10mm pistol built into his right forearm extruded through the port in the palm of his right hand.
"All right," he said. "Now listen carefully. We'll never make it on foot. We'll have to grab one of their choppers. They'll be setting down at the rear of the house on the lawn between the mansion and the hedgerow. Everything between the hedge and the harbor is mined."
"I know,"
said Raven.
"I used to live here, remember?"
"Right," said Steele with a grimace. "We've got to try and make it out past the hedge without being seen, if possible. Once we get on the other side of the hedge, keep low, hide behind it, and follow my path exactly. Understand?"
"Got it,"
I said.
"All right, get ready."
He slung the duffel bag over his shoulder by its strap and opened the door. He glanced out quickly. The coast, momentarily, seemed clear. He looked up toward the roof, but the men who dropped down onto it from the choppers were already inside, rounding up Higgins and his people. It wouldn't be long at all before they realized he was missing. He glanced quickly both ways.
"Okay, let's go."
They sprinted straight out on a diagonal from the side of the house, heading for the wall that curved around the property from the front, and ran down to the water's edge. The hedgerow was about 25 yards away, but they had to run an extra 20 yards or so in order to keep the back corner of the mansion between them and the rear of the house as long as possible. Steele went first, with Ice bringing up the rear, Raven running in between them. They were about halfway there when several men came running around the side of the house from the front. Townies, not troops. One of them shouted on spotting them and brought his rifle up, but he never had the chance to fire. Steele fired his laser, dropping him in his tracks, and two loud reports from the .44 brought down the other two. There was still some sporadic firing coming from the front of the house, so no one noticed the shots and all the confusion. They reached the waist-high hedgerow, and Steele quickly took a reading on the other side with his metal detector.
"All right, it's safe. Come on."
They vaulted over the hedge and came down low behind it.
"Okay, now stay below the hedge," Steele cautioned. "And go exactly where I go. Understand?"
"You don't have to tell me twice,"
said Raven.
"I'm not about to go all to pieces over you."
She grinned at him.
"Cute," said Steele with a grimace. "Now let's move fast. Come on."
They started crawling, staying below the top of the hedgerow, keeping it between them and the rear of the mansion. Steele kept taking readings in front of them with the metal detector and the turret attachment on his left wrist. Every few yards, they had to move out away from the hedge, circling buried mines placed directly behind it. On the lawn at the rear of the house, three large NOTAR X-Wings sat like predatory birds, their carbon fiber blades rotating slowly. The troops they had brought in were already inside, crawling along at what seemed to them like a snail's pace. They moved closer and closer until they were directly behind one of the helicopters, its body between them and the house. The hatch bays on both sides were open.
"Okay," said Steele. "Now when I say go, move fast toward the side of the chopper."
He glanced up over the hedge.
"Go!"
He vaulted over the hedge, sprinting toward the chopper. He reached it and leaped in through the open hatch in the side. The others came in right behind him. The pilot started to turn around, looking like an invader from outer space, with his head totally encased in his VCASS helmet. He found himself staring at the laser turret extending from what appeared to be a Gatling gun on the end of Steele's left wrist.
"Don't make a sound," said Steele. "If you get on the radio, I'll hear it, and you'll be dead before you say two words."
The pilot nodded, the bulky helmet bobbing up and down.
"Take off the helmet!"
The pilot complied. His eyes were wide and frightened. He swallowed hard.
"Don't kill me,"
he said.
"Please! Unstrap yourself!"
The pilot hastened to comply.
"Right!
Now get over here!
Fearfully, the pilot moved toward him, his hands raised.
Look, I'm just following orders! Keep your mouth shut and do what you're told, and you'll get out of this okay,
said Steele.
Now sit down on the floor over there!
The pilot swallowed hard and sat where Steele indicated.
Raven, keep him covered!
She drew back the bolt on the assault rifle and aimed it at his face.
Okay, okay,
the pilot said, sitting with his hands clasped atop his head.
I ain't gonna move a muscle, lady, I swear! Ice, get in the co-pilot seat and strap yourself in!
I hope you know how to fly this thing,
said Ice as he did what Steele told him.
I took a download on it some weeks back, said Steele.
You mean you ain't actually flown one before?
Nope.
Shit, this liable to be real interesting.
Steele donned the VCASS helmet and ran through a lightning flight check as the data appeared on the inner visor of the visually coupled airborne systems simulator. He looked over his shoulder.
You, pilot!
He said, his voice sounding mechanical through the helmet speaker.
When I say jump, you go out through the side hatch and run like hell. And if you know what's good for you, you'll stay the hell away from the other choppers. You understand?
Yes, sir. Okay, get ready.
The rotors whined as they started to speed up.
Eagle 3, what the hell are you doing?
Steele ignored the voice coming in over his helmet. The blade spun faster and faster.
Eagle 3, come in. Jump!
Yelled Steele. The pilot leaped out through the hatch and took off running like a scared rabbit. The chopper lifted off and turned around on its axis.
Come in, Eagle 3. What the hell do you think you're... What the fuck? Who's flying that thing? This is Steele in Eagle 3,
said Steele over the helmet radio.
You've got 5 seconds to evacuate those birds before I open fire.
As he hovered barely 4 feet above the ground, he lined up his weapons pods with the other two choppers.
Shit.
He waited until he saw the men leaping out of the helicopters and running away from them. Then he fired a rocket into each chopper. They went up in balls of flame as Steele brought the helicopter up in a sharp climb.
All right,
said Ice as the helicopter rose up over the mansion. Suddenly, another chopper came up from the other side of the house, directly opposite them. Its guns started firing the moment it cleared the roof line. And the cockpit bubble shattered as bullets punched through it.
Fuck!
Said Steele. He fired another rocket and whistled through the air, just above the roof of the mansion, and struck the other chopper dead on. It exploded in a wash of flame. Steele circled high over the mansion, nose down, firing at the other chopper on the ground in the front, shooting off its tail section. Then he swept the helicopter around in a steep turn and headed out over the harbor.
Damn it!
He swore.
Why the hell did they have to?
Steele!
Raven shouted.
Ice is hit!
He ripped off the helmet and glanced at Ice strapped in beside him. A large section of the cockpit bubble directly in front of him had been shot away. The big man's entire upper body was a mass of blood.
Oh! Hell! Said Steele. Ice!
Done bought the farm,
said Ice, struggling to get the words out. His blood frothed on his lips. He coughed and spat up an incredible amount of blood.
We gotta do something,
Raven said frantically.
No way,
said Ice, coughing up more blood.
Too bad, Higgins. Can't fix me up like you.
Oh, Jesus,
Raven said.
Ice! Hold on,
said Steele.
Hold on!
He turned the chopper toward the city.
Give him hell, policeman,
Ice said. He showed his teeth in a gory, bloody grin. Then his head slumped forward on his chest.
Ice!
Said Steele.
Ice!
Oh, God,
said Raven.
He's gone.
As the chopper hurtled toward Manhattan at over 200 miles an hour, Steele threw back his head and screamed with helpless rage.
Ah!
End of chapter.